Hi guys, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Nuggets News, or our monthly housing and economy update with our friend Martin North. I hope you've had a good Easter, Martin.
Yeah, very good, thank you. But no Easter bunnies and no chocolate for me, but it was good. So, I feel as though the minute's been devalued. You know, it seems to be that every month, every year, it's getting quicker and quicker and quicker. So everything's being devalued.
Time does feel like it's speeding up with all this crazy stuff happening around the world. So any thoughts before we dive into the slides?
Yeah. You know, every time we say it's crazy, it's getting more and more crazy. And, you know, we're coming up to the election, of course. We've got the issues in the US. We've got the trade. You know, wherever you look, there's craziness. So trying to find a center of gravity, I think it's really important to get away from it all and get out and enjoy nature. So that's what I did over Easter. And I feel much better for it.
Absolutely. Same here, Martin. Got a few hikes in, and it's, the weather's been awesome still down here in Tassie. But let's dive into these slides. So a bit unusual here with bond rates hovering around 4.4% while the dollar's been crashing.
Yeah, this is really weird, right? Because you would expect if markets, yeah, particularly equity markets, are down, that there would be a flood into the bonds. And because the yield and bond prices move in opposite directions, you would expect yields to be dropping. But it's not. And you'd expect the dollar to be stronger. And it's not. So there is something new on the block, which is raising the question, you know, is the financial system that we've been speaking about for a long time now getting to the point of duress? What's causing it? We've spoken previously, of course, about the massive debt and everything else. But this is a very important potential inflection point, and it raises a whole bunch of questions that we're going to try and explore today. So the next slide is just making the point that the DXY, which is the dollar index, dropped on Liberation Day. And then when the tariffs were delayed, it went up and then it dropped again. And of course, when the threat from to Powell from Trump, it fell again. So it shows you that this is directly connected to what Trump is up to. And it's interesting also, if you look at now the expectations from the markets about the valuation of the S&P 500, pretty much everybody has cut their forward estimates. That's partly, of course, because a lot of corporates will not be able to generate the revenue because, of course, costs are higher and they may not be selling as much. But to me, these are very important signals. And if you go on to the next side of the argument, the only thing that really is booming is gold, you know, up at 3,479 US, it continues to rise. You know, digital gold, Bitcoin, well, it's up a little, not quite as strongly. But, you know, pretty much other than, you know, those particular ones, everything else is down.
Yeah, and I never thought I'd see the day where you said Bitcoin was digital gold, Martin, but here we are. But that's kind of in terms of physical gold, then, yeah, that's, as we say, with all this money being sucked out and this being a multi-trillion dollar market, this is the place where it's going. And gold is going parabolic, and maybe these forecasts, the $5,000 and $10,000 gold that people have been saying for years and years, will eventually end up being right. Mm. In terms of crypto, yeah, we, the team and I, with all our data, they did redeploy some of the profits we took near the top, and we think the bottom is hopefully in for Bitcoin when it got down to 74. So we'll see how that plays out.
Well, Peter Schiff, of course, has been very vocal over recent times, and he's been a long time gold advocate, and is basically saying, well, you know, the US economy is being wrecked. It's all about Trump, et cetera, et cetera. And if you go to the next slide, clearly the tariff story is part of the story here with, you know, the tariffs imposed on China, although we've got smaller tariffs now being imposed elsewhere, and there are negotiations underway, et cetera, et cetera. But the other thing is this Trump-Powell issue with effectively Trump calling for Powell's termination. It can't come fast enough. And in fact, he doubled down today with a quite long message on socials saying we need interest rate cuts, otherwise we're going to get a slowing down. That sounds like you know, a recession or something. So let's just work this out. So basically, Trump has imposed all of these tariffs, obviously, you know, trying to rebalance the global trade order, et cetera, et cetera. The markets are crashing. Money's going out of the US because they're having a lack of confidence. And now, of course, he's turning to the Fed chair and saying, well, you should cut interest rates because otherwise we're going to get a recession. I mean, this is crazy, crazy times. You know, everybody else has been lowering. Why aren't you? And of course, Powell came out just last week, he gave some commentary in Chicago and made the point, well, we don't know what the impacts are going to be yet. We've still got an inflation question to try and deal with. And we'll react at the right time. So it's becoming a real question. And in fact, if you look at the next slide, this is quite interesting. Wall Street Journal opinion piece, basically talking about the question is, could Trump fire Powell? What does that mean? Would he have to get rid of all of the other people? Because it was a collective vote, of course, not just Powell. This is a recipe for market uncertainty. The tariffs will cause at least a one-time increase in prices, but it's going to probably go beyond that. Markets are spooked because I don't know if Trump listens to anyone but his own impulses. All of that is there. And the other side of it is interesting. Trump was quite clear that the tariffs would not impact consumers in the US, but you only have to look at the adverts now in the US for cars. Buy before the tariffs come in. We're going to have to put prices up by 25%. So, consumers are going to pay. So this is a recipe for fear, uncertainty and doubt. And the root cause is not just the tariffs. The root cause is now the question of independence of the Fed. It's been an independent for a long, long time. There could be court cases. There are a couple of other officials from the public sector who got fired, and they're taking cases to court now, and that could be quite consequential. But since the 1930s, the idea has always been that the Fed is independent. If that independence is basically swept away, then all hell will break loose.
Yeah, and just to remind people, this is the backdrop of some bills calling to end the Fed and politicians, and the push in Europe for central bank digital currency. So is this all a tactic to usher in the sort of digital age and end the Fed in that manner?
Yeah, and I'm not a favour of, I don't support central bank interventions the way they've done it, but independence of central banking, of course, is a cornerstone foundational element in terms of the way that the financial system has been designed for the last 100 years or so. So are we effectively now entering a new era where effectively all the stones are up in the air and where they're going to fall? And what does it mean? And just to give you a little flavor on the next side, when the tariffs were first announced, Goldman Sachs came out almost immediately and said, oh, we're going to get a recession. And then 73 minutes later, they removed their forecast because Trump said, oh, no, we're not going to actually do all these tariffs now. We're going to give that 90-day period for negotiation. I mean, how you can, as a corporate plan in this environment, how you as an individual can, decide what to spend money on. No wonder people are actually saying our confidence levels are dropping and we're not sure what's going to happen. The expectation of inflation is much higher. I mean, this is consequential for the US, but, of course, the spillover elsewhere is dramatic as well. And whilst we had some flight to quality to Europe and places like that, the fact is that nobody is going to be able to escape this. One of the reasons why gold is very strong is because that's seen as the last bastion, the last holding point. Central banks around the world are requiring gold. Some investors are requiring gold at the moment because there's nowhere else to hide. The dollar, the mighty dollar, is now in question.
Yeah, and I just saw on Twitter just before China have introduced the first gold ATM where you can deposit bars or coins and it will test them, melt them down and deposit into your bank right then and there. So that is interesting, something I hadn't seen before.
It's fascinating. And so, next slide, there's a bit of a debate about can Trump fire Powell? What happens if he does? How will he do it? And I don't think this is going to play out immediately. But, I made a show the other day on the next slide just saying, in a hyper-financialized world, it's the bond markets that rule, because effectively the bond markets are saying, we don't trust what's going on in the US. We want a higher return if we're going to actually invest in the US. And that's why the interest rates are very high. And of course, if interest rates are high, it's not the Fed setting interest rates. It's the bond market setting interest rates. And so to an extent, the Fed can intervene or not and try and set some of it. But if the financial system basically says, we don't believe the US is now that backstop, that critical cornerstone of the financial system, then boy, we are in a whole new world of pain, because of course, what's next? And that's the interesting question, as you said earlier on. You know, is it a plan? Is it effectively a miscalculation? What does it mean for, the global South? What does it mean for China? What does it mean for the crypto community? I mean, there are so many big questions. We can't answer them all today, but it does show that all of these things that we've been talking about for months, they're all in play now.
Yeah, and as you say, it's important for people at home to understand that if you were to end the Fed and they say, well, where do interest rates get set? The bond market, as you say, already started to price in inflation well before they were too late to rise. So there is another mechanism for the sort of free market to determine interest rates as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the markets are, bond markets in particular tend to be well ahead. And look, where are we? Well, this next chart just shows you, this is a stylized evolution of the way that markets work. So you go with the stamp money and then the institutional investors pile in, and then you get the greed and the public money, and then you reach a high and you say, oh, we're in a new paradigm, and then we have effectively a bit of denial of fall, what's called the bull trap, where effectively it drops and then it comes up a little bit higher and comes down. My thesis is we are in the bull trap area at the moment. I wouldn't be surprised to see a little bit more of a fall and then up and down, but the risk is we now get capitulation, which basically means returning to those longer term means. And if we did that, then the stock markets are overvalued significantly. The bond markets would go higher, and the financial system would be a very different place. And just to give you a bit of a flavor, if you look then at the markets, the Dow Jones is down, significantly down. The S&P 500, significantly down. And the NASDAQ, well down. And if you look at that, the little inset there is actually Tesla. That's 43% down from the start of the year. They've got some reporting to be done in the next little while. So all of those indicators suggest to me that we are actually in a very uncomfortable place. The markets don't know quite what to do and where to go. And just to give you a bit of a flavor on that, look at the VIX, the volatility index, the fear index. It's up at 32. It's been higher, up 55. But the real takeout for me was what Mohammed Al-Alarin said. Wall Street's biggest banks reaped $37 billion in trading revenues in the first quarter of the year, their best performance in more than a decade. This is a reminder, as the intermediaries with the ability to widen bid offer spreads, these banks often benefit from financial volatility, provided markets don't malfunction as they did in 2008. And that's the point. There are winners in all of this. Who are the winners? It's the big trading players. It's the big banks who are making a mozzarella in all of this mess.
Yeah, and as you say, Martin, so when everything's functioning well, that bid-ask spread is nice and tight. As we get this volatility and it all starts to widen and people suck liquidity out of the markets, they're making $37 billion just on collecting fees and whatnot. So as always, it's kind of like the banks win no matter what.
Yeah, and did you see also Trump and his cronies were actually in the White House celebrating when the markets jumped back up after the after the tariffs were announced, and he was celebrating all of the money that had been made, including in the people in the room. I mean, let's face it, a lot of those people are very rich people and they're benefiting from all of this volatility and uncertainty. So again, Trump, who was very much painted as the person looking after the poor man, is actually the rich man getting richer, and his cronies are getting richer. And so, there's a real question mark here that needs to be answered.
Yeah, and if you know your history, when the markets crashed, in the Great Depression, that sort of thing, it was, the wealthy bankers that cleaned up or bought up all the assets. And so if we were to get that chart followed through, I think we'd see so much social chaos for the average man on the street as well, which just makes me wonder how far they're willing to push this sort of controlled demolition reset that they seem to be pushing.
Yeah, and it does really come back to who's in charge, who's pulling the strings. Do they know what they're doing? Do they not know what they're doing? I think, to be honest, there's a lot of confusion in the minds of the people in the White House as to what's going on. They're jumping from issue to issue to issue. I don't think there's necessarily a coherent plan here. But the fallout for ordinary people is huge. And on that note, let's just tip the conversation now, talk about Australia, right? Because we've got an election running at the moment. And up until now, the mainstream media coverage of the election has been really, really bad in Australia, right? None of these strategic issues that we've been touching really have been discussed in the mainstream media until we actually got Bloomberg, that came out in their Bloomberg Originals with a show talking about the fact that the Australian lucky country is now at risk, high debt, you know, low productivity for the first time. And also pretty much the same time, the ABC came out with a piece on the gas reservations and why high energy was a real problem for Australia. So a little bit at the edge, the media is starting to tell the story. And I made a show called Finally, Some of the Mainstream Media Are Telling the Economic Truth. Well, sort of. They didn't really go into the root causes, but you know, they are the exception. Most of the coverage of the election and most of the discussion around the issues are just not getting to the heart of the issues. And I think that's really frustrating.
Yeah, and I've had a lot of people that sort of send me links and clips. There's been some really big international YouTube channels doing videos, you know, the fall of Australia. And as I did my documentary 5 years ago now, saying this, all these things that are structural, if there's no change, it's going to get bad here. And the last lever they're going to pull to float the housing market is immigration. And you look at how hard that they're pushing that now. It's all playing out. And it's really sad to see us going down that path, the same as Europe.
Yeah, I agree. And I made another show called Some Sliding Moments on the Fractured Australian Property Market. And just quickly, the first one was the question of Parramatta. So there's a build-to-rent project in the centre of Parramatta. I think it's a 46-storey tower, and they want to build there. Build-to-rent is not a solution to our housing problem. It just is going to lift rents even more. The second one was the closing of... in the centre of Sydney, effectively housing for elderly men in the middle of a leafy Paddington. And that now is being converted, or they want to convert it into a 4 new dwellings. So there's a massive stoush around that. So how can we actually have a housing situation where people are being pushed out simply because people want to redevelop? And the third one was Morgan Cox. I spoke, I think, about him the other time we were on. He was the guy on ABC Q&A, asking some hard questions about migration and renters. You know, he's a renter. He can't afford to continue to pay his rent, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Morgan didn't get a good answer on Q&A, but he's decided to double down. So he's actually now camping out outside Albo's place, the $4.6 million house. And you can see there the Everybody Deserves a Home Albo. costofliving.casualties.com.au, tell your story. But interestingly, the police came up to him and said, you can't actually put Albo on your sign there. So he actually had to paint out Albo. So, you know, this is a classic example of he is the face of the problem in terms of rental. There are thousands and thousands of people who have nowhere to live. And yet, it wasn't really discussed through the election campaign. And, you know, take that a bit further if you go on to the next one. Okay, we had some policies from both sides of politics, but they were both pretty weak and really aren't going to move the dial very much. And there were some minor differences, but, you know, the economists pretty much slammed it. But the next slide for me was said it's all, we're just going to spray some money around, right? We're going to spray some money around ahead of the election. Of course, we're solving the housing problem. No, they're not. And as Ben Phillips said, election housing policies for first home buyers mostly will benefit the middle and high income households with little benefit for struggling low income renters. Spot on. That is the point. So neither side of politics have actually got any policies dealing with the critical issues of homelessness, pressure in the rental sector. It's disgraceful. And yet haven't heard that discussed in the mainstream at all.
Yeah, it's the uni-party system, and people are starting to work this out globally. The amount of times that politicians all around the world have promised to do X, Y, Z and got in and done the absolute opposite. It's just crazy. As you say, you've got to sort of walk your own path and develop your own sovereignty and save yourself, because no one's coming to save you, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think you put out a tweet to that effect the other day, which I think got quite a good reaction. Yeah, you know, there are still people out there think, oh, the government will save us, you know, the US will save us. No. This is down to the decisions that you take as an individual and as a family and as a community, right? There is no silver bullet coming over the horizon. That's the problem. And by the way, just on the housing construction issue on the next slide, you know, people have saying we need to build more. Just remember that compared to almost all of the other countries, we have built more per 1,000 people over the past decade, only after Switzerland, right? So, you know, we're right up there compared with the UK or the US. So it's not like we've not been building much. It's just that with high migration, we're not building enough. But it's almost impossible to amp up the capacity to build more. And, you know, the 1.2 million homes that Albo is promising, they won't get built, not because there isn't land, but because we can't get necessarily the construction momentum that we need. And of course, they're also competing with a lot of public sector construction. So, you know, the net result of all this, as Chris Richardson said, labelling the housing policy offered by both parties, dumb policy and the dumpster fire of dumpster stuff, right? It's too much money chasing too few homes. So adding extra money is going to make prices go even higher. And that's really the critical point, right? And by the way, you are basically now going to say the taxpayer is going to sweep up defaults rather than the banks or the LMIs in this model. And as the next slide shows, basically, there's a commitment from both sides of politics for what? Higher home prices, despite the fact that home prices are massively higher than they were relative to income, you know, massively different. And so this is just policy on the run, not necessarily getting to the heart of the issues and yet creating more pressure and more pain. And by the way, the housing fund, the HAF, is likely to need a bailout because, of course, the markets have crashed compared with where they were. And as Cameron Kushner said, only in Australia would a government set up a housing fund that doesn't build any new homes for several years and that then might end up needing a bailout. This is an absolute mess. And by the way, Cameron Murray warned the HAF was a risky, expensive, unnecessary waste worthy of a story arc from Utopia when he said a few years ago, I think. It's crazy, crazy, crazy.
So for people at home, Martin, that housing fund, just in a nutshell, is the idea that they're going to have all this money invested in like equities and stuff and then use
$10 billion in equities, and the income generated from that investment will then go into funding housing. That's basically the idea. Yeah. So rather than putting money directly in, it's gone indirectly into the markets, except the markets are down. And that's the point. So, you know, if you go below 10 billion, then it's going to be harder to get the returns. You know, they've also got a commitment from the Greens for a 5% return every year. So they've got to pay out 5%. But the problem is if the fund goes down, it's going to be harder to get that 5%, which means basically you are going to have to put more money into it. So the whole thing is ridiculous.
Yes, couldn't agree more on that. Okay, here's the overseas migration chart.
Just to say that the latest data shows that migration is still very strong, as Tom put it. Seriously, 200,000 new arrivals in the country in just 30 days in the middle of a housing and rental crisis. If I was young, I'd leave Australia. Your government seriously hates you. I think that's a very good summary of what's gone on, right? And, well, the politicians, of course, on the next slide say, oh, we're not worried, you know. And did you talk about negative gearing or not? Did you get an inquiry about negative gearing or not? And, you know, there was a Dutton Albo moment where effectively Albo said, no, we didn't get, formal advice from Treasury. Was their modelling done? Well, again, you know, I'm not sure who's right, who's wrong here. All I can tell you is that negative gearing is definitely part of the problem, but there's a big, big issue with migration, a big issue with the financialization of property, a big issue with too much lending from the banks. You know, I could list all the, we've discussed all the issues before. The fact of the matter is we have a housing crisis, we have a rental crisis, and we have a political system that is not up to dealing with it. And this election just really shows that in spades.
Yeah, and in my Evil Elite series, I've been talking about this great replacement theory that has been outlined on their official websites in terms of this is a deliberate strategy to sort of cause chaos, and from that chaos they can introduce new laws and have more power to roll out digital ID, central bank digital currency. So we're just watching the playbook, unfold in slow motion.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. There's a lot going on here. And, the political discourse is rubbish. And by the way, if you look at the latest polls, the primary vote says there's a lot of people not going to vote for the majors, you know, 33-35%, no surprise there. And Tara Brooker, I think, made a really interesting point. For every first preference vote the majors don't get, they're going to lose $3.386 in funding from the AEC, right? So if you want to make a, just remember that. So if you vote for some of the smaller parties, it means that the big guys don't actually get first preference money. That's a really important observation. And by the way, two party preferred, ALP slightly ahead compared with the coalition. This is basically off from April the 13th. It's probably changed a bit now, but it's interesting that Leif Van Onselen made the point that voting for either major party is like picking between two different types of poison. And he went on to say the only policy the coalition has is the excellent gas reservation policy, but that won't even get up because it's probably going to be Albo going to get back. This is madness. So again, I'm afraid that the whole political discourse is, you know, a bit rubbish. And by the way, as Craig Kelly put it, and I love this guy, if you keep voting the same way, expect the same result, right? You know, two sides of the same bum. And that, of course, is exactly right. So we need a different discourse. We need a different approach. And
who do you think is our best candidate, Martin? For me, I think it's probably Senator Rennick that's been the most consistent on calling out, you know, freedom of speech, some of this, you know, just these big issues and the corruption and whatever. He seems to be one that's not bought or paid for.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, not all minor parties are the same, but I would say almost any minor party is better than the majors. But yeah, Rennick is definitely up there. I did do an interview with Andy Schlemo from the Citizens Party, who's Senate in New South Wales, who has some very strong views about the corporate corruption and what needs to be done there. I think look at the local, because it varies by state, of course, as well. Look at the local third-party candidates and look at their policies and try and pick, you know, the least worst or the best. But the point is that the major parties have deserted the bulk of Australians. It's clear. Mm-hmm. They're not interested in trying to solve the issues that are of import to most Australians. So we need to find a different way. The political system is there to use it. So make sure you vote appropriately. And, you know, I'm not going to tell you who to vote for, but, you know, don't just turn up and think, oh, well, I've voted for X, I'm going to vote for X. You know, do a little bit of thinking. This is a really important tipping point, in my view, because things are getting so serious. And if we just get more of the same old, we're going to get just you know, a worse and worse environment in Australia. So this is an important election.
100%. Okay, so RBA minutes warning of rate cuts.
Yeah, so just then talk a little bit about, you know, what the RBA will do in May. They probably will cut. You know, they are cautious. Inflation's still high. Unemployment is looking pretty good. The economy is not doing that bad. And it's interesting that in their last minutes, they made the point that if interest rates were to drop, and that could lead to riskier borrowing, and they're attentive to the vulnerabilities that might build in the financial system. The vulnerabilities, they're there already. Look at ordinary households. And there's a chart here that shows that when rates are cut, house prices rise. So not only have we got the two parties offering policies that are going to put upward pressure on home prices, but the RBA may well cut. And on the next slide, you can see there that you know, they're open to an interest rate cut. And on the next slide, it's interesting, even Warren Hogan, who was a standout in terms of saying they shouldn't be cutting, has now he's changed his forecast. He's saying they're going to have to because of the impact of confidence and sentiment is strongly negative, going to have an impact on business and consumer spending. So even he is now calling for a couple of cuts. And the latest that I've seen there is CBA is calling for three cuts. Westpac's calling three cuts. ANZ's calling three cuts. NAB is calling five cuts to a rate of 2.6%. My own view is, though, that these cuts are probably not going to be as severe because the bond yields are in the wrong place, right? Remember we talked about the bond yields and market rates? Well, the bond yields in Australia are still quite high, not as high as the US, but if the financial system continues to go higher and forces effectively bond yields higher, that's going to put significant pressure on the ability to cut. And of course, we've still got high inflation, and those tariffs, directly or indirectly, could actually lead to higher costs of things too. So I don't think it's a done deal, but that's where the markets are at the moment. I'm more skeptical of such deep cuts. There will be some cuts, but not as deep. And on the other side of the equation, just to sort of round the conversation out, it's really interesting. You know, the CBA data on average household costs, just they published it. This is an annualized percentage based on the second quarter. And it showed here that rental costs on average are up 13%. Mortgage costs are up 11%. Tax paid on salary about 5%. And spending is only up 3%. But interestingly, the cumulative growth, if you look at the difference between what CBI said on the CPI rental and what the ABS said, it suggests the ABS number is understating the real rental cost rises which is consistent with what I've been seeing, because in my surveys, I've been saying for some time on the next slide that rental stress has gone through the roof. 77% of households are in financial pressure in the rental sector. And if the CBA number is right, and I think it probably is close to the truth, it shows you that the ABS number is rubbish.
Yeah, that's just a wild statistic. And I remember, how many years ago did we start this show now, Martin? 6 years ago, 7 years ago, I think. And it's just crazy to see how high this rental stress has got, and just so much red tape in Australia, as you say, in a place that's got plenty of land and plenty of resources to build. It's all just bad policy.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, half of households with a mortgage are in difficulty, and that's up from 30% before COVID. But it's the rental stress. And that's the coming back to my point. The rental stress story wasn't center stage of the election campaigns. It should have been. One third of the population rent, and it's rising, right? More people are actually struggling with finding somewhere to live, and it's a disaster. And that's why we've got more people in tents, more people living in cars, more people just couch surfing or living with other friends and family. It's a major nightmare. And frankly, I'm very disappointed that neither side of politics, from a mainstream perspective, has spoken about this. Even some of the minor parties have been a bit lax on it too. So for me, this is the really critical, pointy bit of the election. And just before I finish, I just want to highlight that today was Cash Out Australia Day, right? So Tuesday, the 22nd, people have been actually out withdrawing cash. Just to highlight again, cash is still important. And I would say that in the current uncertainty, in the current environment, where there is so much craziness going on, cash is ever more important. And I believe that cash will remain king for much longer than people are claiming, not least because, of course, if the digital systems go wrong, you can't use cash, not least because if you get digital control of your bank accounts, you can't use cash. So the point is, we got to make sure that cash is absolutely front and center of what goes on. Have you heard one debate, one issue where cash has been spoken about through the election campaigns? I haven't.
Yeah, and as we saw in those floods in Queensland, places that weren't even that badly affected had no power for 10 days and that type of thing. So it's going to happen, and it's scary if they roll out digital ID and central bank digital currencies and don't allow cash. So let's do everything we can to avoid that.
Yeah, and cash is there. It's legal tender. It's legal currency. Don't believe what the banks are saying. Cash is really important. And, frankly, when the power goes off, at least if you've got cash, you can survive. If you don't have cash, you've only got digital, then you're, stuck. And unfortunately, we've seen a lot of evidence in recent years where people in regional communities in particular have been completely stuck because the power's gone out for days. And what do you do?
Well, guys, hope you've enjoyed our show. Leave all your comments and questions down below, as always, as I think this is becoming really popular, Martin, and we're starting to see more people passionate and tell their stories and everything around Australia as we head into this election or whatnot. So thanks as always, and we'll catch up again next month.
Look forward to it. Take care. See you, folks.